The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
It's a small book, but it is a cracking read, and it is so topical. The Border, The Legacy of a Century of Anglo-Irish Politics. It's a new book by Professor Diarmaid Ferriter. Now, where to start? I'm fascinated by so much of the stuff. Actually, we had Andy O'Donoghue with us earlier talking about technology on the border, Diarmaid. And you actually quote a writer called Gareth Carr from the time when the border was very operational at the British Army. When stationed on a border, one officer jotted down what it would take to seal the whole length. 303 miles of mesh fencing, a vehicle track along the entire length, a hinterland security fence, 360,000 explosive charges, 165 miles of vehicle hazards such as ditches and steel spikes, 100 pillboxes, 100 concrete observation towers. The defence would also need command posts, bunkers, dogs, dog runs and thousands of arc lights. All of that before the boots on the ground are considered.
That's not a pretty sight, is it?
No.
Not a pretty prospect at all. Gareth Carr wrote a book called Rule of the Land, and he actually repeated something that Con Tobin had done back in the late 1980s when he walked along the border and got a sense of it. It's not a political book, but he was, of course, dealing with the political backdrop and the political history in various chapters. And that was a response, what you've just read out there, to this idea that you can seal the border, because it was suggested at various stages that the border needed to be sealed because it was so difficult to police it. Its sheer meandering complexity. You know, how do you actually secure the border, which became a very contentious issue during the Troubles in particular. And he was just addressing that fascination with the length of it and the amount of crossings. And he was making the point, the same point Colm Tobin made. Colm Tobin met someone, he was trying to get from Castle Derg and Tyrone to Derry. And he met somebody who gave him advice as to, you know, what route he should take. And he said, you'll be going into the north and then back out and then in again and then back out. And Colm said to him, well, how will I know whether I'm in the north or the south? And he responded, well, you won't know. And he kind of smiled gruffly. And that was his way of saying the only people who can understand this hinterland are the people who are actually living on it.
So who designed that border?
That border was really planned according to the original county lines. The original county lines were established at the counties. The boundaries of the counties were established in the 16th and the 17th century. And when it came to 100 years ago when they were devising a plan for partition, there were different options on the table. One was that you could use local government administrative units. Second was that you could use parliamentary constituency units. Or the third was that you could just go with the original counties, no matter what they cut through. And that's ultimately the option that they went for because they felt it was the most manageable. Ironically, in light of what you've just been talking about, but they were also thinking in terms of what do, you know, these counties represent politically. What's a viable size for a new state of Northern Ireland? There was originally the proposal that it be a four-county Northern Ireland, so that you'd have
We'd have kept Tyrone and Fermanagh.
Antrim, Armagh, Derry and Down would be Northern Ireland. And then it was felt that that was too small, and there were, of course, demands from the two remaining counties that had, of course, sizable unionist populations. So it's a mess. It's a ridiculous border in a geographic sense. When you consider,
which makes it impossible to implement a hard border on in the event of a no-deal Brexit, presumably.
Well, you can implement a semblance of a hard border, which can be problematic enough because we did have, of course, a hard border, but you can never have an absolute border. Certainly not in the Irish case because it's just simply...
Which means it'll be rife for smuggling.
Oh, it's always been rife for smuggling. I mean, some of the smuggling stuff is very amusing in the sense that it brings it down to the everyday level. You know, anyone along the border had a vested interest in smuggling, be they orange or green. And at various stages, it was about small items like shoes and bread and chocolates, depending on wartime restrictions or depending on prices going up or down in the different jurisdictions. But of course, it also had a very serious side, which was fuel. And fuel smuggling has always been an intrinsic part of the Irish border experience. And of course, a lot of people got very wealthy on the back of it. But again, how do you police it 100%? They were also targets, of course. You know, those who were implementing customs and those who were responsible for policing the tariffs on either side of the border. The border has always been a target. I mean, it's such a contested symbol, and for some it's the ultimate symbol of British misgovernment in Ireland.
Well, I'm going to read the opening paragraph of the book because I think this sets it up brilliantly. The island of Ireland was partitioned in 1920, partly due to a combination of British duplicity, the insecurities, fears and desires of Ulster Unionists, and the delusions and dashed hopes of Southern Irish Republicans, and partly because the likely alternative to a border was civil war. In subsequent details, the border was cemented by aggressive political ideology, economic policy and harrowing violence before his potency was tempered by a peace process and economic and political pragmatism. And on that final point, that's what we're in danger of losing, isn't it?
Well, the pragmatism has reigned for the guts of 20 years now. Part of the peace process dividend was not just the dismantling of the hard border and the infrastructure around it to make it less contentious. It was also that idea that people could come to an accommodation, a peace process accommodation, that this was something that psychologically they could begin to deal with much better. And it's in the mundane details there, you know, that you could live and work on opposite sides of the border. You could send your kids to school over the border and that it's invisible in that sense. And that was the pragmatism. It was also, of course, economically pragmatic. We've heard all of the figures, 30,000 trips over the border every day, 110 million motor journeys every year across the border without any hindrance. That works for everyone, regardless of your political persuasion. And one of the reasons why there was a shared hymn sheet in relation to no return to the hard border, even from the DUP, was precisely because of the pragmatism of a soft border. Who wants the tailbacks? Who wants the checks? Who wants the inconvenience of it? It doesn't make any economic sense. Even 100 years ago when the border was being devised in private, a British cabinet minister said, you're cutting off the normal circuits of commercial activity. This is a very artificial and absurd boundary. Now, they needed it for political reasons back then, but they were well aware of the practical difficulties around dividing such a small country.
And yet the ignorance in Britain, deliberate in many occasions, of what the border actually means, is quite staggering at present. I made a TV documentary just before the Brexit vote in 2016. We went across Maglen, the scene of the old British Army barracks there. We interviewed Aaron Kernan, the Armagh footballer, about the whole thing about what roads, in which direction you went, where you'd be in the north, where you'd be in the south, how difficult it would be for people if the barriers came up again as they went about their daily life. Went over to England to talk to various people about it as an aspect of their decision, their vote. There were just no interest and no concept of what it actually would mean.
Well, there's a depressing continuity there because Lord Salisbury, who was a senior Conservative politician in 1924, wrote that the English voter had little interest in and less understanding of Ireland and of the Irish question and indeed of the Irish border. It has always been thus. Let's not delude ourselves into thinking that Ireland was remotely a priority when it came to broader British and English concerns. We were small fry and they saw it as something that was an irrelevance.
Is that the irony then of the DUP position in that the DUP actually realises that, unionism realises that when push comes to shove, the English don't really care that much about them.
But that is why they have such a siege mentality. It's not just about what they would see as the aggressive designs of Southern Republicans or Northern Republicans. It's also about distrusting London. They have never trusted London.
And there's a fantastic line you have about Tony Blair, who at one stage given out about the Orange Order.
He was infuriated because, I mean, he goes over and makes much out of this foreign policy initiative and the importance of the peace process and bringing the two sides together. And then he gets a delegation from the Orange Order in 1999, and they speak to him like he's a piece of dirt. And he says, I'm the British Prime Minister. These are the people who fervently want to remain in the United Kingdom, and yet they're treating me like I'm some kind of hostile entity. So there's always been that. But even when the border was created, Edward Carson, who of course led them to the barricades in resisting Home Rule in 1912 to 1914, he said, with the creation of the border, you're cutting us off. You are basically telling us that you don't want us. So they didn't trust, they accepted the border, they accepted Northern Ireland as a price worth paying at that time. But it didn't mean that there were warm relations between Unionists and London. Yeah. And that remained the case.
But it's not just the British fault, is it? I mean, what about us in the Republic, almost starting to regard the six counties as a foreign country?
It would be very lazy history now to indulge in crude Brit bashing in relation to responsibility for the border. The border was born with the assistance of Irish midwives. But it's also the case that Southern Ireland, what became the Republic, relied mostly on rhetoric around reclaiming the fourth green field. They didn't prioritise consent. They didn't prioritise dialogue. They didn't seek to understand the reality of the Northern Unionist mindset. Not only that, successive governments refused to allow Northern Nationalists a hearing in the Dáil. MPs, Nationalist MPs like Eddie McAteer and Paddy Maxwell in the 1950s were demanding a hearing in the Dáil to raise their concerns. And the way Eddie McAteer put it, the door was shut on us and we were told that we didn't want the Republic didn't want any reproachful voices from Northern Ireland to disturb them in their comfort zone. So there was that psychological barrier there, a profoundly partitionist mindset in the South that it is a different entity, and we will rely on it perhaps sometimes come election times to bang the tribal drum and rally the troops, but we're not really interested in engaging. So that's why the border hardened. That's why you had that sense on either
but
side
how much
of
that
entrenchment.
Was down, how much that was down to our political leadership as well, and that a succession of Taoiseach didn't really seem to care, that they were actually quite happy with partition
they
and had a rather jaundiced attitude, not just of unionists, but of nationalists in the North.
Absolutely. And I mean, they were prisoners perhaps of that era, of the revolutionary era. But once they achieved their own southern state, they want to maximise the sovereignty and they want to maximise the security of that. They didn't want the trouble spilling over the border. And that's a consistent theme throughout the Troubles. When Paddy Hillary was appointed Minister for External Affairs and the outbreak of the Troubles in the late 1960s, he went to Ivy House, the headquarters of the Department of Foreign Affairs, and he said, "Where's the Northern Ireland desk?" There wasn't a Northern Ireland desk. There wasn't a unit within the Department of Foreign Affairs to deal with this. And it was a measure of the neglect. And you also had Sean Lamass, who begins to use a different language and starts to try and focus on economic cooperation between North and South. But he also derided in private Northern nationalists as old women. Now, there's nothing wrong with old women, but he didn't mean that as a compliment. This was an insult that he didn't trust them and that he felt that they were, as politicians, lacking in any kind of creativity or self-sufficiency.
There's been some criticism of Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney's insistence on the backstop. The likes of Dan O'Brien, The Economist, has argued that by the insistence on it, we've created the very problem that we wanted to avoid. Others like Owen Harris have also called upon for a sort of softening in the position. But from your assessment of the history of the relationship between Ireland and Britain across this border, could Leo Varadkar have trusted the British to live up to their word on anything softer than what went into the backstop agreement?
No, he couldn't. And there's a very obvious reason for that. The border was supposed to be temporary. The promise of 100 years ago was that Ireland would be allowed to work out its own salvation. That was the very wording that was used in 1920 in relation to a Council of Ireland that would seek to bring the two sides together. David Lloyd George, who was the British Prime Minister at the time of partition, was not someone who could be trusted. He spoke out of both sides of his mouth. We've already seen how Theresa May can't be trusted, the various commitments that she made that she's now backtracking on. And Theresa May herself said before the referendum that it was inconceivable that if the Brexit referendum was passed, that there would be no hard border. So there's a huge issue there around trust. But at the same time, Varadkar and others shouldn't be immune from criticism for their approach, because at some stage they're going to have to confront the reality that they can't keep saying this is Westminster's problem, it's up to Westminster to devise a solution. It's not just Westminster's problem, it's very much our problem. You know, and it's okay at the moment to talk about EU solidarity holding firm, but ultimately Brexit is going to impact Ireland more than anybody else. And there does need to be an engagement beyond the mantra that this is Westminster's problem. But trust, of course, is a profound legacy from 100 years ago and after that as well. The various suggestions that were made about, you know, London holding the ring that would, you know, preside over attempts to try and bring North and South together or to some kind of accommodation. They frequently reneged on that. They often said in private, and it's there throughout the book, throughout the decades, British politicians often said in private, this is a ridiculous border, we would like nothing better than for you to come together. But they wouldn't say that publicly.
OK, one final thing. We've gone way over time, but there is one other small thing I want to ask you about. De Valera was offered a deal by Winston Churchill during the Second World War, a united Ireland as the prize for Ireland, giving up neutrality and supporting the Allied war effort. Did De Valera make a mistake in not taking up that offer, or was he right to say the British can't be trusted to live up to their word?
Of course he was right. Right for two reasons. First of all, Churchill was drunk. Second of all, Churchill had not consulted the unionists about whether or not they would agree to this. So De Valera quite rightly saw that there were problems on both of those fronts.
It's a great read, and it's a short read. It's a fantastic primer for anyone who wants to know the history of the border, the legacy of a century of Anglo-Irish politics. Dermot Ferriter, thank you for joining us here on The Last Word on Today FM.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.